Sounding good, Tom. We'll start in just about a minute. So if you want to go ahead and send a note out to your audience, that would be great. And then we'll listen to a little bit more. We've got a few people already on. So again, we'll start in just a minute.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right, Tom, how about 30 seconds and then we'll get started. Everybody's enjoying it.
What I do to relax.
All right. Well, thanks, Tom. Well, we'll go ahead and get started. And hello, everybody. I'm Jan Rutherford with Self-Reliant Leadership. This is our fourth LinkedIn Live session we've done. And today it is my great privilege to be with my dear friend and my favorite philosopher, Tom Morris. Tom, if you could introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Tom. I grew up in a family where nobody had ever been to college. So I was lucky to get a scholarship to go to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, then on to Yale for graduate school and taught at Notre Dame for 15 years before becoming a public philosopher, a job I never knew even existed. So now I guess I've given over 1,000 talks, maybe it's up to 1,400 for every kind of group imaginable. I've been writing books since I was 22 years old, so I think I'm up to 30 in print at this point and got a couple underway right now. So I always have fun as a philosopher. People call me the world's happiest philosopher, and I don't know how big an accolade that is because I haven't known a lot of happy guys who think deeply. But I try to rediscover in our time the practical side of philosophy, the side that can help us all in whatever challenges we face and give us, hope moving forward and confidence that with lives based on real wisdom, we can not only survive the tough times, but come to prevail and grow in new ways. So it's and I've known Jan for quite a while now. So it's great to be with you here, Jan.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And you're coming to us via Wilmington.
Yeah, Wilmington, North Carolina. About a mile from the ocean.
And I'm about an hour from the Pacific Ocean out here in Oregon. So amazing technology. Let me ask you, of all these books you've written, which one are you most proud of?
You know, it's funny. I've done this before in my life. When my 14th book came out, The Art of Achievement, a book I never thought was going to come together. It took me actually 14 years to write it. And I gave up on it at one point and had to let it stew for 2 years. And it came out and I said, this is my favorite book I've ever done. And I've sort of kept that in mind until just recently. Plato's Lemonade Stand, the book that came out in January, I believe that's become my favorite. And it's hard to pick a favorite child, right? But in books, it's a little easier. I mean, my favorite work of fiction is The Oasis Within. But I never thought I'd do fiction. But my favorite book of philosophy in a nonfiction mode is Plato's Lemonade Stand. It took me 15 years and 25 versions to write that book. And so it was a kind of an ordeal to learn the wisdom of the great thinkers about turning life's lemons into lemonade. But I used the ideas I was learning, and the result is really great.
Well, good. Well, good. I love all your books. And that's how I first came to know you. Gosh, probably in the early 90s, I think. Yeah. I read that book. Well, you know, philosophy is all about starting with really great questions. So let me remind our audience that your questions are very welcome, whether you're on LinkedIn or you're on Facebook. Yeah. So we're monitoring those, and we'll be glad to interject those. I've got a few, and I thought I'd start off with some softball kind of questions. So you ready for just some real easy questions, Tom?
Yeah, toss me a real easy pitch to start.
Okay, here's a real easy one. Is suffering a necessary part of the human condition? What would people who never suffered be like?
So by suffering, you mean being asked questions like this. Basically, that's what's happening.
Exactly.
I it's a surprising thing that I've come as a philosopher to understand the deep importance of suffering in our lives. I had a professor at Yale. First time I ever went into his office, he was a theologian. He said to me, Tom, I believe most people suck the foam off the beer of life and never drink the beer itself. And I said, say some more about that. That's really a great image. And he said, too many people live superficially. They skim the surface of life and they glean whatever they can of life's pleasures, but they never really experience life deeply. And oddly, the more we talked, the more it started to come out that it was his view and has increasingly become mine, that the pains and sufferings we go through in life aren't these terrible inconveniences, but they're, in a sense, the things that crack the shell and deepen us. One philosopher early in the 20th century was asked about a number of the mystics throughout history. And the questioner was a real aggressive atheist. He said, well, you know, these mystics, they were messed up people. They were cracked individuals. And the philosopher responded, well, maybe you have to be a little cracked for the eternal light to shine through. I've always liked that.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, one of my favorite books, Jan, that I recommend to people all the time, let me get it on the screen. Mm.
Florence Scott Maxwell,
The Measure of My Days, written in her late 80s. And she says in the book, the things in my life I most regretted while they were going on, the sufferings and the pains and the agonies, have ironically created in me the qualities I've most come to treasure and cherish. She uses the term hardihood to sum up these qualities. She says, without the sufferings, without the bad times, I could never have grown in these ways. And I look back at my own life so far, and I think, you know, the worst things have always opened the door to the best things. And typically in ways I couldn't have imagined while I was going through the suffering. Right. So we want to rid the world of suffering. We do. If we're good people, you know, let's alleviate the suffering of others. And yet that's never going to be possible entirely. And that's probably a good thing spiritually. So, that's a deep question. And we're suffering through a very challenging time right now that's going to generate creativity and innovation. is going to be a time of self-knowledge for people. You know, what are my assumptions? What are my safe zones? What are my comfort zones? How can I possibly stretch in this new period where the old ways of doing things don't work anymore? We're going to be goaded on to become our best creative selves amidst some great suffering that people are going through. Even those of us who are healthy right now, we're suffering deprivations of all sorts, and we're doing interesting things in the interim.
Well, you had said last time we spoke, a month ago, I think, you said something to the effect that you thought this is all preparing us for something.
Yeah, I've seen that as a pattern through my life, and not just through my life, but as I read history, that when people go through particularly difficult times, it ends up turning out that they were being prepared for something great. Those who live seemingly superficial lives of easy pleasures and easy comforts usually don't end up making a big dent in the universe. They usually aren't the folks who lead us forward into new breakthroughs, but it's those who've had things break through their own lives in difficult ways who can lead us all on to new breakthroughs. So yeah, I do always have a feeling the tougher things get, the more of an optimist I become, because I believe it's a pendulum swing that will then take us to a new form of action. I think we've taken for granted a lot of structures in our society and in our world that weren't really healthy for us in the first place. And now we're being given an opportunity to rethink a lot of things that we wouldn't otherwise have rethought.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. We've got a question that just came in from a dear friend and fellow veteran, Jen Birch. And she said, after deep suffering, we learn from our mistakes and learn how to pick ourselves back up and move forward. Something I've had trouble with after hitting rock bottom is self-confidence. Any book recommendations or advice on how to improve this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Florida Scott Maxwell's book, first of all, would be first on my list. And
you want to show that again?
Oh, yeah. And then number two would be the book of mine that you showed a few minutes ago, Plato's Lemonade Stand, because there are too many people who try to draw their confidence from their circumstances. The greatest people in history have brought confidence to their circumstances, not waited for their circumstances to give them confidence. And there's this great thing. I love the Stoic philosophers. I was reading Epictetus and Seneca and Marcus Aurelius again recently, and they had these amazing images. I think it was Seneca who had the image of a boxer. And he said, until a boxer has been bruised black and blue, felt his teeth rattle under the fist of an opponent, you know, tasted the ground as a result of an onslaught, until then can he enter the ring with true confidence, because he knows what he can experience and endure. And Epictetus had a similar thing. He said, imagine you were given great resources and decided to become a champion Olympic wrestler. What would you do? You'd hire a coach. And what would that coach do? He would give you every adversity and every obstacle. He would bring against you the best opponents he could find. You would have the toughest time of your life. Why? To create new wisdom, agility, and strength. That's exactly what's going on in the world around us right now. We're being prepared for something that Epictetus says much greater than a mere athletic contest. And so we're being given every adversity and every opponent so that we can cultivate agility, strength, and wisdom.
Agility, strength, wisdom. Let me ask you this. I was just listening to a podcast or a webinar with Katie Milkman and a company called Humo. And she's talked about nudges and the fact that we humans are not very good at delayed gratification.
Yeah.
You know, that planning for the long term. And just last night, I was on with a group of great veterans in a mastermind group, and all of them had wonderful goals. And I think one of the things that they were all struggling with is this big goal of mine I have is super important. It's not real urgent at the time. You know, I'm not sure when I should really start tackling it. I mean, what's your thoughts on the whole idea of, you know, delayed gratification and delaying pleasure and, you know, embracing the difficulties and adversity and those types of things. Thoughts there?
Yeah, it's very important. And those who put off big goals. And there are different reasons for doing this, right? Because there's what Socrates once called the trivial urgent. He said, ooh, there's so many things that come in our lives and demand attention right away that we hardly ever get around to the truly important things, you know? And this was in his time, you know, a millennia ago. Yeah, some people, it's just that there's too much in their life. There's too many distractions. And so they keep postponing the one thing that can be postponed. It's not urgent, but it's really important. But the lack of urgency allows you to postpone it. And I often counsel people on the magic of small goals. If you have a big vision, a big goal in mind, start setting those small goals now. You can fit those in amongst all the distractions and minor urgencies of life. You can fit those in. And they won't create huge discomfort, but they will lead you ultimately to the big goal. I like to give this example. I started working out seriously when I was 58 years old. I had never really done much with weights. I had never really bench pressed, maybe once when I was 22 years old, but my whole life I hadn't done bench. I saw a guy about my age benching 85 pounds. And so I thought, I was 58 at the time. I thought, oh, okay, I'll do that. I got a workout partner who younger than me, who would watch me do this and say, you know, that looks a little too easy for you. Put on another 5 pounds or put on another 10 pounds. For years, he suggested to me tiny incremental new goals. I think you can go up today. Let's try another 10 pounds. By the time I was 63 years old, I was benching 315 pounds. Now, if I'd started out saying, okay, here's my goal, you know, one day I want to bench 350, no, absurd. I would never even have thought of that. But the magic of small goals along the way is they get you on a path. And once you're on the path, you can begin to see things you couldn't have seen from the outset, possibilities that would not have manifested themselves at all.
It was interesting. Katie Milkman mentioned some research that basically said if you told somebody save $150 a month, chances of them doing it are low. If you told someone every single day, put $5 in the piggy bank, that people can do that. People can take $5 a day and throw it in there. And so, you know, and I think the interesting thing to learn from people like you that have written 30 books is really obviously there's some component of self-discipline because everybody out there wants to write a book. Everybody wants to write a book and very few actually get around to it because it's hard.
It's hard. And yet when you do it right, it's not just hard. It can also be the most joyful thing you've ever done. It's like we look at championship athletes and we say, oh my goodness, look at how often they're getting hit and how often they're falling down. And that must really hurt. And yet when you read what some of the greatest champions across sports have had to say about their most amazing endeavors, they were in what psychologists call a flow state. They didn't even feel the passage of time. They didn't feel the pain. In fact, there was an exuberance. There was almost an ecstasy about it. And in my books, it's the same way. I mean, I can look at the clock and see that I've been writing for 6 hours and it'll feel like 30 minutes, you know? That's on a good day. On a bad day, when it's the pain and suffering you're talking about, I'll say, okay, I think I'll play my guitar for a while. I'm going to play with the dogs and cats for a bit.
Well, let me ask you this, Tom. I'm going off topic a little bit, but when you describe the books you wrote, the fiction, I mean, it's almost unbelievable the way you. And I'd love for you to describe to the audience what happened when you wrote these books.
Yeah, I never thought I would write fiction. You know,
right? But how? I mean, what happened in your head that made you? I mean, if you could describe that and also put it in the context of, I mean, is that something you could teach or convey to somebody?
It's very interesting. My father had this attitude toward life. He said, life is supposed to be a series of adventures. The one you're in now is preparing you for the next one in ways you probably can't even imagine. Hmm. Well, my whole life had prepared me for breakfast in a February of 2011. I had toast and coffee. I pushed away from the table. I was going to go work on what became Plato's Lemonade Stand. But before I could get out of my chair, it's like I'm having the most vivid daydream of my life. I'm in the kitchen and I'm in the desert somewhere. And I'm seeing an old man sitting in the sand with a brightly colored blanket up against the tree of some kind, and a young boy, and they're talking. They're having this amazing conversation. It's like watching a movie. I ran upstairs as fast as I could. Just felt like I was supposed to write this down. I typed as fast as I could. The movie stopped playing for minutes for me to get upstairs. I started typing as fast as I could. Got 10 pages, put them on Huffington Post. I got emails within an hour from all over the world. What is this? This is great. Is this a part of a book? I said, I don't know what it is. Next day, 10 more pages. Make a long story short, for 5 years, most days, the movie played in my head, and I just typed as fast as I could. It became 8 books of over 1 million words, set in Egypt in 1934, a place and time about which I knew almost nothing, and it's become the most magnificent experience of my life. I was in a state of constant joy in writing those books for 5 years, and it's like everything I'd ever learned and stuff I'd never even thought about. It was like everything was coming into the story like drinking from a fire hydrant. It was the most amazing thing. And details about the Middle East and about Egypt and about Arabic and about things that I'd have to look up the things at the end of the day, the things I'd seen in my movie. Are there poisonous snakes in the desert in Egypt? Yes, it turns out there are. How about a certain kind of car in Cairo in 1934? Yep, there's that car in Cairo. Mm. It's like more philosophy. There's a grand old man. His name is Ali. He's my Gandalf. He's my Dumbledore. I've learned more from him than from any physical teacher I've ever studied with. And so if anybody has a chance to go to theoasiswithin.com, go look at these books.
Yeah. So how did you block out all the distractions? The trivial urgent. How did you deal with that?
This relates to your question about discipline. If you're doing something you're passionate enough about, the discipline doesn't feel hard. In fact, the discipline feels not only necessary, but great. Under the onslaught of these stories, it's like the only thing I wanted to do is to sit and see what was going to happen next in the movies. It was like the easiest thing I've ever done, but the most extensive workout. I'd be in a swimming pool in Scottsdale, Arizona, prior to a speech. And the movie would start playing in my head, and I'd have to run into the spa and say, I need a lot of paper. And they would give me legal pads, and I would sit and write 3 chapters of the book on legal pads. I'd be in the Atlanta airport. All of a sudden, the ending of the series came to me. I didn't want it to be the ending. Tears were streaming down my face, but I felt obligated to write it down. 2 books later, it was the exact ending of the series. Things like this would come to me. So the discipline, that's an odd thing. When you're doing something you love, the discipline isn't something you just have to grind out. It's something that just becomes part of your receptivity to the experience. And it's almost like you don't realize you had to be disciplined. And I was lucky. I was in an environment where my wife could take care of a lot of the ordinary things of daily life, right? And I was in a comfortable situation where I could spend 2 to 6 hours a day writing. But I tell other people, if you want something like this to happen in your life, my most creative period was in my late 50s and early 60s, and on to now, I'm 68 years old. I've learned how to get out of my own way. And I've learned the wisdom of certain Eastern philosophy that talks about emptiness as a spiritual quality of great worth. If you empty yourself of your concerns and worries and thoughts and hopes and dreams and ambitions, if you can empty yourself out, if only for a while, you make the room for new things to enter. And if you get out of your own way, you make room for new things to happen. I don't feel like I had any agency at all in these novels. I got out of the way and let them happen. I began to understand the Bhagavad Gita and certain Eastern literature because I'm trained in the Western tradition of philosophy. And I remember reading things in this regard, but never really understanding them until I had that experience. And then I understood Scottie Pippen during the Bulls when he and Michael Jordan were winning all their championships. And Scottie said during the greatest games, it was almost as like we weren't making any decisions. There was no effort involved. I mean, time stood still and Michael was where he was supposed to be and the ball was where it was supposed to be. And he describes it as if it were passive. Now, as we watched it, it looked like they were working really hard and making split-second decisions all the time, but he experienced it very different because he was in his zone. He was in his flow. I think we can all experience that, but we have to get out of our own way to make it happen.
Yeah. And when you talked about emptying yourself and being open, it made me think of a lot of the discussions taking place in corporate America right now about diversity and inclusion. I mean, being open to other things. But let me shift gears real quick. I want to show you a comment we got from my friend David Ortiz. And David is a military veteran and was wounded pretty badly in the war, and now he's running for office in Colorado. And this is what he wrote: "Then there are some that get forged in life or death situation and survive and become better for it." Oh. And that leads to my next question, actually, David. So thanks for the segue. Does hardship make a person stronger? And if so, under what condition and at what point is it too much hardship?
Yeah, that's a good question. Does hardship make us stronger? Well, the answer is, I think, from all the philosophers, it can. Hmm. But that's up to us. There's always a freedom. We have to partner with the hardship. Nobody ever explained that to me before. But life is all about partnerships. And not just with other people, like on a basketball team or on a Green Beret team, not just with people in challenging circumstances. We do have to partner with other people. And Aristotle had this formula for the peak of human good. If you read his politics, you can extract this formula: people, plural, in partnership for a shared purpose. People in partnership for a shared purpose. One of the revelations in my own life as a philosopher is that not only do we need to partner with other people to make great things happen, we have to partner with the things that come into our lives, like difficulty, like suffering. We have to become a partner to help the suffering create in us something good rather than something bad. It's like the parable of the sower and the seeds in the New Testament. Jesus says the sower goes along, he's tossing out seeds. Some falls on the hard path, it can't get root. Some falls down where the birds pick it up and fly off. Some falls amongst weeds and the weeds choke it out. But finally, there's good soil. And I talked to a biologist about this one time. I asked him, what is good soil? And he said, good soil is dynamic, it's active, it's full of life. It partners with the seed. And I think that's the way we have to treat adversity. When a situation comes our way that's unexpected and unwanted and it disruptive and it knocks us back on our heels, we have to figure a way not to flee the situation necessarily, but to partner with the situation to create together something new and something perhaps really good that couldn't have happened otherwise.
Well, do you think, in addition to that we need to, you know, not only focus on that difficulty, but focus on the things that we're grateful for? So, yes. Does that make, you know, us humans better off, that we're really focused on what's going well than just the difficulties at hand?
That's part of what makes you a good partner, right? The difficulty brings the negatives. You better bring the positives. And so the way you do that is by working in your own mind to be thankful and grateful and hopeful. To be confident when the situation is not giving you the basis for confidence at all. But these are the things you can bring. And the more mature, spiritually mature you become, and I say the more spiritually we become, the better we're able to do that. I mean, in the book, If Aristotle Ran General Motors, I have a chapter on business and the meaning of life. And I come up with this conception of the meaning of life, sort of summing up great wisdom traditions, that meaning is about creative love or loving creativity. And we have this ability to be creative. You know, who was it? It was maybe Mondrian, the painter, who said, confronting a blank canvas, there are infinitely many possibilities. Once a painter begins to touch the canvas with paint, he begins to eliminate possibilities. I never thought of it that way. He said the most difficult stroke any painter makes is the very first stroke. That's why it's so hard to start new things. But painters start new canvases all the time, and so can we. I mean, there's a sense in which the pandemic has given us a blank canvas in a lot of ways. It's taken off a lot of the things that we had on our canvas, right? And so we have an opportunity now to be creative. Will we bring to that creativity to complement yin-yang, the difficulty, hope, optimism, thanksgiving, gratefulness, confidence? It's up to us to bring those things. The difficulty has its negatives, but we can help work with those to create positives. Like the mud that becomes the beautiful pot, right? Things don't often start off looking good, but through our skill, we can partner up with the raw materials we're given and make something good result.
Well, there's also research that shows that when people are most open to change is when they perceive a fresh start.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I mean, we're trying to reboot a whole bunch of organizations and economy and all kinds of different things. And they also say that the limit of choices actually, boosts the possibility for innovation and creativity. If there's too many choices, it's hard. Does that relate philosophically?
It does. And I see far too many people in our culture right now trying to get back to the way things were in January as fast as they possibly can, whether that's the right thing to do or not. It's the old comfort zone. And so people running back to the old comfort zone, right? No, we have an opportunity now to rethink and redo. And uncertainty. There's a chapter in The Oasis Within. And we've been holding up books, so I'll hold up the cover of the Oasis.
There you go.
There's a chapter called The Gift of Uncertainty. And the old man, my wise old man, says to his young nephew, consider the possibility that uncertainty is a gift. And I remember thinking, what? uncertainty is a source of anxiety and fear and frustration. But he gives us a new view of uncertainty as an open field of possibilities. And if we can be open to the openness of the field of possibilities, amazing things can happen. But if we shut down and run or put our heads in the sand, we're not going to see the possibilities that are all out there in front of us. Life is like a kaleidoscope constantly being turned, right? There are new patterns emerging. Mm-hmm. The successful people in the world tend to be those who spot the new patterns and the new opportunities they present, while everybody else is just feeling confused. But we all have that ability to focus.
Yeah. Well, let me, you touched on some things. So let me ask you the penultimate philosophical question. And my mentor used to ask me this. He would always grab me by the forearm. And actually, he was a Notre Dame grad, Tom. But he'd grab me by the forearm and he kind of shake my hand and he'd look at me and go, Jan, what's a good life?
Oh.
And then he asked, are you living one? So that's my question is, what's it mean to live a good life?
Yeah, that's a big question, isn't it? I've got a book actually that I've had sort of outlined a little bit for the last 30 years that I keep working on called The Good Life Crisis. Mm. I was with a group of company presidents one day and their spouses, must be about 200 people in the room. And I said, just a spontaneous idea. This is the age of the old overhead projector. So I put a blank piece of plastic on the overhead projector. And I said, you guys, what comes to mind when you hear the phrase, the good life? And all over the room, like popcorn popping, people were saying, money, luxury, nice home, travel, entertainment. And so I made this list of things, and I had about 20
on the overhead projector.
On the overhead projector, I'm writing with my pen on the overhead projector as fast as I could. And so we had about 20 things, the good life. And for some reason I pulled the transparency off and put a new blank one on. And I said, all right, erase your minds for a second. So let's start from scratch. Suppose you hear the phrase a good life. What comes to mind? People started saying things like love and friendship and faithfulness and spirituality. And totally, I got like 20 items on this list. It took a lot longer. But we put the two lists side by side, and there was no word on both lists. And I said, okay, here's our challenge. Can you live the good life as a good life? And it's like, what does that mean? Well, we're going to have to start from the list, the items on our second list, right? Love and friendship and family and meaning and purpose and spirituality. We're going to have to build on that. I mean, the great philosophers have always said that life is supposed to be an inside job, working from inside out. Get those inner things right, and then the outer things can be right. Chase the outer things first and foremost. They'll never satisfy, right? So the good life is about Well, the idea is, if Aristotle ran General Motors, the good life is about truth and beauty and goodness and unity. The good life is about self and society. It's about self-knowledge. It's about love of others. If we get all these facets of our lives right and in harmony with each other, we can live a life that's good in every possible way. And that seems to be so elusive for so many people nowadays.
Well, you know, as an executive coach, one of the first questions we start with someone when they hire a coach is, what do you want? And you think that's the simplest question in the world. And that's sometimes we'll spend months just figuring out what somebody wants. Why do you think that is? It's so hard for people to articulate what they want. Are there just too many choices these days? And 1,000 years ago, we just worried about where the next meal was coming from.
Yeah, right. Like the grocery store experiments. You put 31 versions of jelly on a display and people walk right by. You put 7 versions of jelly, almost everybody stops and buys one, right?
Right.
So it's the paradox of abundance, where you don't know where to start. You don't know where. And it's almost like when you ask somebody, what do you want? It's half of the people you ask that may never have even thought about that before, because they've lived a life of being told what they need. Mm-hmm. And so they've never stopped to ask, well, wait, what do I want? And half the messages they've got, or maybe 2/3 about what they need, are false messages in the first place, things that lead them away from what they truly ought to want, but don't realize. So that's a very wise question. That's why Socrates said, you know, self-examination. A life without self-examination is not worth living. Know thyself. The Oracle at Delphi, all the great Greek philosophers, and people think that's going to be the easiest thing in the world. But like you say, you discover pretty quickly it might be the hardest thing in the world.
Yeah.
But everything good is based on that.
Well, you know, the whole idea of know thyself, I think people know that at a rudimentary level.
Mm-hmm.
Like someone might say, hey, I know I can be gruff.
Yeah.
I know I can be gruff. And I think they say, well, I know myself. But I don't think they know, well, what effect does being gruff have on other people? And then thirdly, do you have the ability, to regulate your emotions and respond in a way that best serves others, not just yourself, your pride, your ego? Did Socrates talk about that when, as far as knowing thyself, at a deep level in how it related to other people, or was it just self-knowledge?
No, he more exemplified it than explaining it. For example, Socrates was not a guy. A lot of people think of self-knowledge. Oh, that's the thing you get when you sit by yourself in a room and maybe use the single greatest tool of coaching, the blank sheet of paper, and you make a line down the middle and you start listing things on both sides, and that's the way you get to know yourself. But Socrates didn't do that. He was out on the street talking to other people all the time. So the guy who admits that he can be a little gruff, if he were to ask the other people around him and they felt free to be honest, they might not use the word gruff. They might use the words like monumental jerk, right? And so what we have to do is realize that we filter things through what we want to believe. And we need to listen to what we ought to believe from other people who are not always right either, but we need the feedback to mix and match and self-analyze and self-criticize. Part of self-knowledge is self-criticism, not just self-affirmation, but it's to be realistic about, you know, what are my weaknesses? What are my flaws? And sometimes for those, you have to, you know what? Sometimes for our strengths, we have to listen to other people. I know plenty of examples of people who have great strengths that they're somehow not aware of, but if they listen to others, they can be told, they can be clued in. So self-knowledge can be, again, back to the idea of partnership. We have to ironically partner with others to come to the greatest solitary pinnacle of self-knowledge.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of great questions, one of the my favorite guests we ever had on the Leadership Podcast, the show I co-host with Jim Vassilopoulos, was Tom Rath. And he co-wrote Strength Finders and a number of other books, and ended up writing a book called, you know, Life's Great Question. And one of the things he said at the end of the show was the penultimate question was, what's the one thing you can do today that will continue to grow in your absence? And so my, you know, I think it's a great question. And my question to you was, you know, what actions in our lives have the longest reaching consequences?
Yeah, I think it two things. I think it's acts of self-knowledge, increasing self-knowledge, which is sometimes hard. And it's also acts of planting seeds, seeds that will blossom in the lives of others as well as in your own life. Often when people come to me and they say, we have a great philosophical conversation, they say, okay, what's next? What should I do next? I'll say, read a practical book of philosophy. And it doesn't have to be one of mine. You know, it could be the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, right? It could be the Discourses of Epictetus. It could be a lot of things, but something that will spur you to stretch your thinking and maybe change your conduct, your behavior in small ways that will be beneficial for a very long time down the road, so that when you've forgotten maybe everything we talked about today, you will have planted seeds in your own life through your own reading. And if you like the book, read it a second time. And if you still like it, read it a third time. Because last year, for example, I read the Iliad twice, which I probably read twice before in my whole life. I read it twice in 1 year, and I read the Odyssey four times last year, which I probably read a couple times in past year, but only by repeated reading was I able to really suck all the juice out of these books and really figure out what they were about and really learn in my own life some lessons I didn't learn the first time through or the second time through. Florida Scott Maxwell, her little book, The Measure of My Days, I think I just read it for the sixth or seventh time. It's a little book. It's probably 100 pages or less, and I keep going back to it. Now, you may not want to read Don Quixote 12 times, you know, because that's 900 pages. That's enough to go through once. But the classics are classic because they have a lot to say. A great writer once said to me, a book never becomes a classic just because of the beauty of the language or the cleverness in it, but always has to be because of the great ideas that were expressed in that book. And that's what
It's interesting. You know, you said something that, you know, Mother Nature, God, whatever you believe, will keep throwing the same lessons at you until you learn them.
You'll keep getting harder forms.
Right. Yep. So I've got a question from somebody. One of my former students, Brad Williams, who was a great student, and he actually was with us on a study abroad trip to Ireland. Wow. And he asked, what's a good way to get real feedback from others, especially if they're direct reports?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, I think it's got to be anonymous as possible. And there are creative ways of doing this too, right? Imagine that you had a boss who's a little like me. What kind of advice would you give him for the future? So this is not asking to comment on the past where you might hesitate saying embarrassing things. But it's encouraging someone who's a little like me in a situation a little like ours. But give him your best advice how to move forward in a powerful and positive way. And I think you'll be able to read the tea leaves from those answers in a way that might be very candid, more so than the usual 360 evaluation.
Yeah. Oh, good. And Brad, thanks for asking the question. So Tom, we're coming toward the end of our conversation. I had two more questions, and they're a little bit more personal.
I was hoping you didn't save the hardest for last.
No, I got the hard ones right in the beginning. And again, this might be a hard question because you're a humble man, but what do you attribute the biggest success in your life to? And how about your largest failures?
Both love. The greatest successes of my life have been the things I was the most passionate about, the things I love the most, the things that you're just not going to stop me. I don't care what obstacle I face. I'm going to keep going because I love this so much. My father, again, who was an early philosophical influence, who was a 12th grade graduate, never went to college, but he read philosophy all the time, his whole life. Ralph Waldo Emerson he was reading, you know, or he was reading C.S. Lewis, or he was reading just great stuff. And he would say to me things like, do something as long as you love it and you think you have something distinctive to contribute. If either of those things changes, you should make a change. the love has propelled me to all my greatest successes. And the love has always set me up for my biggest failures. Because the things you love and cherish the most, you are most afraid to lose. And that can make you very timid in circumstances where you need to speak up about something, you need to take a stand on something, but you're afraid you're going to lose something that you really love and value tremendously. And that can lead you into making big mistakes, and it can lead you into big failures. Failures of commission and failures of omission. You can do the wrong things or you can not do the right things. In either case, because the love has unfortunately created in you Aristotle would call cowardice rather than courage. You're too afraid to lose something that you cherish. But if we look at things in a bigger perspective, which I've learned to do in my life, when you truly apply love in the right ways and in courageous ways, you'll find out that your vision was too small about the possible losses and failures. It expands your vision. That's why love has been called always a good thing, and everything else, the principle of the dual, the principle of double powers applies to. Anything with power for good tends to have equal and opposite power for ill. It's up to us how we use it. Well, love done right never has this dark side, but done right are the key words.
Yeah, let me ask you about the love part of, you know, the fact that you're afraid to lose it. Cause before you said, you know, hey, part of, what really helped you was sort of emptying yourself, you know, free from attachment. Right. I mean, that sounds like a Buddhist philosophy, you know, to enlightenment that you're, you know, that you're not attached.
Yeah.
And so you can't lose anything.
That's right.
I mean,
and it's like, I follow these guys most of the way. It's like my view of some of the Stoics, like Epictetus. Mm. He goes to extremes. So I don't follow him off the cliff. I'll stop just short, right?
I like that. You follow the philosophers part of the way.
Then, yeah, I let him go off the cliff. I'm going to say, hey, it looks deep down there. It looks fun. But in terms of detachment, in terms of cessation of craving, I like the view of loosening my grip. I hold to things too tightly. I'm not going to throw them away if they're valuable things, but I might productively loosen my grip a little bit, because some of the goals that are so important to us that we grasp on so tight, that's keeping us from seeing something out there that's even better. If we could loosen our grip a little bit, we wouldn't be so distraught when things seem to go wrong. We wouldn't be overly excited when things seem to go right. The Stoics said that, you know, we're far too inclined to say, this is great, this is the best thing ever, or this is horrible, this is the worst thing ever. Hardly anything is as good as it seems or as bad as it seems, so just calm down, they would say. Loosen your grip a little bit. So I don't think I'm able to totally detach, but if I can empty myself out a lot, if I can loosen my grip a lot, then I can approach life with a lot more openness. You know, that grip thing, I'd rather have an open hand than a clenched fist in life. Yeah. Right?
Well, you make me think of mountain biking. If your grip's too tight mountain biking, and part of it, the other thing, there's two things you have to know. One is you kind of relax, and the other one is look at where you want to go. Yeah. Not the rock you don't want to hit. If you look at the rock you don't want to hit, you're going to hit it.
Yeah. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you focus your attention on? Right.
Yeah. So, all right. Last question. If you could teach everyone in the world one philosophical concept, what would that be that would have the biggest positive impact on humanity?
It would probably be my dad's perspective that I've grown so much from, that life is supposed to be a series of adventures, and that we can trust the process, that the adventures we've been on have been preparing us for the ones yet to come. There's too much worry, there's too much fear, there's too much anxiety and negativity in the world, I think, that holds us back from our greatest, highest, and best. But if we could have that confidence that comes from trusting the process. And almost everything in life is a process, right? It's not the light switch that's on or off. It's more like the dimmer switch. And we can be making progress in ways that we're not even aware of. It's so subtle. But if we understand that life is a series of adventures, we don't grasp on to what we have known in the past as something that must continue. and we're more open to that new that might complete us and be even better. But we have to have that loose grip, right? To be able to let go of something, not letting what's good be the enemy of what's best. You know, even in the world of business, Tom Peters, his book In Search of Excellence, all these excellent companies that ended up going bankrupt, you know, or going out of business. And how was I that wrong? He was at no. They became grasping. They became arrogant. They became complacent. They were not open to learning about new things. They wanted to hold on to what they had rather than reaching out to what could be. But if you understand that life is supposed to be a series of adventures, that kind of cultivates in you an openness that one really good psychologist once told me was the single greatest quality in human life. And I think I've come to understand what he had in mind.
Yeah, that's awesome. Tom, I always love spending time with you. I you know, it's like you say you've got to reread the great books. Every time I've had conversations with you and they've been recorded, I feel like I've got to go back and re-listen because I didn't feel like I absorbed everything.
Well, I feel the same way, Jan. And the fact is, you even teach as you ask questions like Socrates did. You know, I love to hear you talk about your experiences, the crucible experiences and the leadership experiences you've had. I always learn so much when we talk. And now I've had this great opportunity to hear you ask questions, and you're just a master of interrogation. Maybe it's your special background, but I appreciate it. It didn't hurt at all.
Well, thanks. Well, real quick, a quick commercial. We're on LinkedIn Live, and we've got four courses out there on LinkedIn Learning. And one of the courses that seems to be getting a lot of viewing time these days is Managing in Difficult Times, and the other course on grit. And that was filmed out on a crucible in Colorado. And we've got another crucible coming up actually next week. We're gonna be in Ouray, Colorado with five executives and five veterans. And wow. We'll be filming a course while we're out there on self-reliant coaching.
Oh, wow.
So so that's what we've got going on. And how can people find you, Tom? Best way to get a hold of you.
I'm across social media, but come to Tom V as in Victor, TomVMorris.com. And you can connect with me on social media through that website, or you can see what I'm up to these days, or you can click to get my blogs that come out about once a week or whenever I have some new idea, spark some new thought. So in Plato's Lemonade Stand that you just put up, if you have a chance to go grab a copy of Plato's Lemonade Stand, I've been getting the most wonderful emails from people who are early readers of that book. And it's very gratifying.
Yeah, I love it. It stays on my nightstand. Tom, thank you again. And this will be recorded. So for those of you that wanted, like me, replay it again, we'll have it on LinkedIn and Facebook, and we'll get it out on YouTube later today. So that's thanks, great. Everybody.